All right, everyone, welcome to Bad Internet Friends Podcast, episode 23, Five Parsecs from Home is the best series ever.
It's hard to compete with, like, if you view it as a movie series, then we might be, like, a little bit behind. Like, the fact that when you hold up the book, the pictures don't move, I feel it puts us at a disadvantage.
Well, it'll be the fourth edition, right?
Yeah. That's going to be the next. It's like those old, do they have them in North America? Those old, like, they were supposed to be like 3D pictures. You had to look at them and like have your eyes look in different directions or something. They were supposed to like pop out of the page.
I remember those, yeah.
Okay. I could never get them to like do anything. Like,
no, me neither.
As a kid, I was like convinced that it was basically a scam or like people were just making up that they were seeing things.
Yeah, that's right. It was the yellow gold dress.
Yeah, basically.
Okay, well, let's welcome Tom, the Psychic Hazard.
Yeah.
Welcome Noised, the author of our theme song.
Yeah, and possibly the most loyal listener just by a number of appearances. Possibly.
I think so.
It might be.
Number one. Yeah. Definitely beating out Torben.
Yeah, sure. He's been slacking up. And it's evening time over there, so I am quite disappointed.
Yeah. This is the last episode of, I guess, the first season.
Oh, I didn't know we had seasons.
Well, it's going to be 1 year, yeah.
Oh, shit. It's been a while.
Yeah, 1 whole year of doing this.
Yeah. So, and we haven't run out of idiotic things to say.
No. We can keep going. We got endurance. We'll do 5 seasons in a movie, and we'll be good.
Mm. Yeah, then you get to reboot. So you get to go back and make a worse version of all of the early episodes.
Yeah, that's right. I think that we should also point out the fact that we might be the only podcast of 2 middle-aged dudes with great hair.
That is true. That's some kind of atrocious hair. So,
yeah.
My family always had, like, my grandpa had, like, amazing hair. But he had red hair, so I don't know, like, what happened. It's funny. My kid has, like, I think he's shown up on screen, like, once. He's got, like, a mega curly hair and, like...
Oh, nice.
Tracy has like a very little bit of curls, and mine is like straight heavy metal hair.
Yeah, but still, at our age, even having hair is, you know, pretty great.
Yeah. I guess it's like all genetic.
Yeah.
I keep. We were talking about it the other day, and Tracy was like, well, "What do you do when you start losing your hair?" And like, if I start like getting the like slightly bald, it's all going. Like, you gotta be committed.
Nice. Gotta be committed. Speaking of committed, we're gonna welcome Von Kapp. Pumped to be here. For this, I am loving tactics so far. It's been inspiring me to write out campaign log reports. Opards. I don't know if I'm reading that wrong, if it was spelled wrong, or if Opards is something I do not know, which is possible.
Operational paper organizer research and development sheets.
Ooh, nice. Yeah.
You know,
that like makes you sense do. To me.
Yeah.
Even custom rules. Very nice.
Hey, man. That is exactly the vibe. Kind of. Getting into the toolbox thing, right?
Yeah. So and before we dive into the 5 parsec stuff, we're going
to
do a little hobby
stuff.
Talk. Yeah. I got this very interesting device right here.
What on earth is that? Because it
this
looks
is called
like
a washless airbrush. So this is like, I don't know, a needle, I guess. Maybe hypodermic. I don't even know. But it's got a hollow point. And what you do is you feed this into here. And it kind of lines up with the brass nozzle. And it's an airbrush, so you turn it on. It has a battery in it, and that's it. The claim to fame it has no wash. So if this needle clogs, you're supposed to just like pull it, toss it, get another one, stick it in, keep going.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. So far from using it, it works well. It's no worse than routing.
Is there any like difference in performance? Or
so far, it seems to be good. Yeah. My first run clogged because it turns out my primer is full of goo.
Oh,
and I plug real fast. But I opened up a fresh Steinel Res, and that ran beautifully. I don't have the miniatures on me, but they primed exactly like you'd expect prime miniatures to be.
Oh, okay.
And yeah, so that this is something awesome. You can just hold on your hobby desk when you need to airbrush. You bring it out, you do a little airbrushing, and just toss it back again. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, that's really cool. That is the way of the future.
Yeah.
Because it's like airbrushes is one of those things, like there's a lot of like hobby, like advanced tools and stuff. I guess it's like the 3D printing thing too, where it's like there's a bunch of bullshit you have to like put up with to use it.
Mm-hmm.
So for each of those things that you know, you can kind of get rid of. That makes it like more accessible. How much did you pay for it? Do you remember?
This was it was a huge kit on Amazon, so it was 140 Canadian.
Oh, okay. And you get a bunch of stuff with it.
Yeah, you could also get them off a different kind off of AliExpress that doesn't have a built-in battery. You have to hook it up to your compressor instead, but it's the same concept. You just feed the cartridge in.
I feel like a battery is way more convenient though.
Yeah, like if you're looking for just something that you can pick up, airbrush, and then toss away again because you're moving on to the next part of your project, this is perfect. There's no setup.
Yeah, and I'm actually wondering.
It's not even really powerful enough to like really atomize everywhere either. So like, I didn't make a huge mess or anything.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I almost wonder if you're using this for like, I don't know, what people use airbrushes for, normal like furniture bits, or I don't know, like maybe it would not actually be powerful enough, but for miniatures, because you're just working with like a small, even for vehicles, you're working with like a little, you know. So yeah, it might actually be perfect. Funcomp has a question on it.
Yeah. Let's see here. So have you noticed any adhesion issues with airbrush primers? I'm using my airbrush all the time, but I've been less than impressed with the primers. Not really, I guess. Rattle can's always a little bit better for adhesion, but I think maybe it's your airbrush thinner, if you're using any thinners, or maybe they got old. Maybe all my primers are old enough now that they came from the good era, the good old days, and now all the new primers suck. It's unfortunately hard to say.
You got to get the primer that still has the Chinese lead in it.
Yeah, that's right. And then it's going to stick right on.
Yeah, you can taste test those. If they taste pretty good, it's the old ones.
Yeah, that's right. And the only other big project I've been working on is I'm working on a squad hammer. Is it ORC or ORC, do you say?
It's technically an abbreviation, but I think I just say ORC. Okay. Otherwise, it doesn't make sense. It sounds more fun that way.
Yeah. Squad hammer ORC. So I've been working on a isometric Final Fantasy Tactics Ogre style miniatures game.
Yeah, and it was inspired by like another thing too, right?
Yeah, Endless Fantasy Hammer. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Yeah,
so
yeah.
A mashup of like.
What was the original one? Endless something. What was it called?
Endless Fantasy Tactics, I believe.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah, it was one of the ones that I had seen like people talk about here and there, and then like nobody like seemed to really stick with it. So.
Yeah, it's super bespoke, the Endless Fantasy Tactics. Like, it is very crafted to be a very certain environment, as far as I could tell, at least. They had a bunch of books,
I see.
That didn't tie into, tied into the main rulebook, but the main rulebook didn't really have much for you to play with. So you got the main rulebook, and then you needed the other books, so you just...
I gotcha.
I think you kind of lost a lot of momentum that way, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's like a gamble, because, like, if people are really into the one thing you're doing or whatever... versus if people are showing up wanting to like roll their own. So
yeah. And so for me, you know, the squad hammer is the epitome of use what you have.
Yeah.
So basing a system off that, but you know, also a bespoke environment. So really all you're really crafting is your tabletop.
You know, a
particular theme you could go for, but the rules themselves do not say you have to use this. You could use your North Star minis, it'd be fine. You can use your Warhammer minis.
Yeah,
you could use little chibi minis.
See, that would be awesome.
Yeah.
Although, I always wish, because you can get some chibi minis, but there's usually not that many. And the ranges that are out there tend not to be like that extensive. Like, because ideally, if you're going to do that, you would also want like a bunch of like chibi monsters and stuff like that. And sometimes it's like hard to find.
Yeah.
So you have to do the thing.
You end up doing the thing where you have tactics. Like, we're doing 3D STLs. I remember the tail end. I think that's before it really picked up too, 3D printing.
And there might be a bunch of like 3D printed just like stuff that isn't technically wargaming minis, but you know, a mini is a mini.
Yeah.
Just look for all the anime stuff and determine if your game is going to be PG-13 or not.
Yeah. So for me, I'm kind of targeting D&D basically. So I think that if you can get something as generic, because D&D is kind of like the basis for most things anyway. So if you get something that fits with the D&D tropes, then you'll probably have miniatures for it.
Yes. And you might be able to buy, I don't know if they still show up. You used to be able to just buy like boxes of plastic D&D minis that people were getting rid of.
Yeah, exactly.
So I had like a couple of big boxes, just like absolutely random crap. And you just like reach in, grab some random monsters and stuff. A lot of the monsters were, the characters were usually a bit shit compared to real minis, but like a lot of the monsters were really cool. And you got some weird stuff, you know, some of those big ass dragons were really cool.
Yeah, I got like a cool jaguar that kind of looks like a displacer beast. I liked it.
Yeah, it could actually have been a displacer beast.
Yeah, that was a Jaguar. I'm not really sure.
I think the original Displays of Beast was actually built of like a cat toy. They put like arms on it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
yeah,
I read somewhere. Cool.
Let's see. Von Kamp said, fair point. Haha, that is true. I have decent results with my Vallejo primers, but the Army Painter primer has been very poor in its adhesiveness. I have no experience with
I would say that the Army Painter primer, just rattle cans I've gotten, have not been like super great either. So I think that's just, I like AP a lot, but they have that like 10% is just kind of not good and 90% is really good. Yeah, I don't know. I ended up giving up and just using, I forget, it's like Krylon or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
You can buy here. That works fine. I don't know. I can't answer what happens if you put that in an airbrush. But yeah, Army Painter primers are just not real good in my experience.
This is how it is. I think, yeah, but they just.
I haven't tested or tasted all of them, so maybe some of them are better. We're talking about how they taste, right?
That's right. In the second year anniversary, we'll do the Army Painter taste test. Rattle can edition.
Yeah. See if there is a difference in how they taste between the rattle can and the bottle.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Because yeah, everyone knows what the bottle primer tastes like.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. That's not a challenge. And you said you've been super busy.
Yes, I got behind on work, which is probably good for everybody because it means there's lots of work. But yeah, so yeah. I have managed to paint like play like one session of a board game. We played, I think it's called Farm Race, last night, which is like, it's basically Settlers of Catan, but like you're playing as farm animals, and then you can like bomb each other with nuclear weapons.
Oh, okay.
So yeah, it's very kind of goofy and funny. We had a really good time. It's a great game. If you sort of like the idea of Catan, but you don't like Catan because Catan sucks ass, this is like a more fun version. It's kind of over in a set amount of time. It doesn't drag on like forever. And there's some of the things that suck in Catan where you can get stuck and not get resources is kind of a little better here.
Okay. The streamlined, animal-friendly bomb.
Yeah, division. There's like a little more to it. It's like if you can teach somebody to play Catan, they can learn to play this. It's like one step up in complexity, but like a little step. But you get to like shoot nuclear bombs and have mutant pigs and stuff. So it was pretty fun. It was great for three players. We played with the kid and then my brother-in-law.
Awesome.
But other than that, yeah, I think the only thing I have played have been like online or online RPG campaign, which is fine. Well, hey, but yeah, it's still a game, so I'm still getting some gaming in. But it's just so, and like when I'm like super deep in work projects, I tend to kind of like back off playing a lot of table or a lot of minis tabletop because I need like a little bit of distance to it. I get the most gaming when I'm just working on like one little project.
Oh, okay.
Then nice. You got to have like a little mental space for it.
Oh. So people who want to go deep into Bad Internet Friends lore can track how many games Ivan's playing.
Yeah, and that'll
tell you what's coming up or if there's going to be a little bit of a lull.
If you're waiting for something to get finished, that is. So, however, I do need to get some stuff to testing once the Victorian sci-fi thing is close enough to be playable, which won't be that long.
All right. Well, yeah, you just need 11 more people to pony up.
Yeah, I think it's reasonably there, but I wanted to get to let's see what we've gotten. I realized some people were ponying up like 40-ish or $45. I was like, okay, I'm going to count those as two because that was kind of
nice.
I think we got to 29, so one short of the original goal. And oh yeah, it's like tomorrow. Well, people can still donate. I'd like to get to 40, but. So have started working on it. We're moving along. It'll be good stuff.
Sweet. And we'll say hello to Waylon X on Twitch. Almost never see anyone on Twitch anymore. So hello.
Hey.
And Jason's here. Yeah. He loves board games.
Absolutely. Board games are great. I could definitely like it. Have you ever thought about like if you had to go back and like pick a different hobby, like what you would pick?
There's a few I passed up to be into miniatures. So
like because you don't have so much time, or you just got into two things at the same time, and one was cooler. But I could definitely have seen like an alternate timeline just being like a board game guy. So I love that.
Well, my hobbies were bicycle repair and miniatures were my main ones, and then one became my job. So that was that.
Well, it's also like you gotta have a hobby that you can kind of like do stuff with, you know?
Yeah. Well, I still tinker with computers. I just picked up it's like a motherboard set off of AliExpress, which has like one of the old Xeon super powerful processors.
Oh yeah.
I was playing around with that yesterday. Those things are beasts for their age. They're kind of insane. Yeah.
There's a lot of videos you see where people will like build like a supercomputer for like 2002 or something, or like 1999.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
which is always cool. You get like the computer that you never could get back in the day. So that stuff is pretty good.
Oh, Tom found his Dragon Dice. I think that's a game, right? Dragon Dice was a game.
Yeah. That was like it was one of those that was like huge for a little bit, and then I think it just kind of like the concept was too limited, so it didn't really like.
There was like a dice game craze, wasn't there?
Yeah, for a while. Like, I think people were trying to find like the next big thing after like collectible card games had chilled out a little bit. But I don't know. I wonder about that sometimes because you see them pop up occasionally. Like even like at the bookstore, they have a bunch of like little dice games. But I think like the appeal is too narrow or something. I don't know. Like, I think people, if you don't have like pieces to move around, people are just less interested, I guess.
Well, maybe that's a deep dive for a future topic.
Yeah. The best deep dives are the ones where we have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah. I don't know why dice games failed. They just are stupid for stupid heads.
You know, people keep putting the dice in their mouth. That's why they don't sell, because you can only play it once.
Yeah. People just kept mixing up their dice by accident and then they didn't know what game they're playing.
Yeah, exactly. It's bad enough with board games. We've complained about the custom dice before.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, at least with a board game, you can put them back in the box, so like you know where they go. I never know what to do with any minis game that have like custom dice, because you don't usually have like a box. Like most games don't come in a box anymore, anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
So you just get the weird dice jar or whatever.
The random bag.
I was packing up a board game that I've sold off. I was just checking like everything was there before shipping it off, and it was. But I remembered there was like this one counter in the box that says hover on it, and I have no idea where it came from. I can't think of a single game that has a hover token, but it was one in this game that didn't belong there. So I wrote the guy and was like, "You're just getting the hover token. We don't know where it came from. You can wonder about it now. Keep it in the box."
To this day, who knows?
But it did come with two, I think, pretty authentic classic Games Workshop dice, because the little like white dice that they would always like put in games back in the day.
Okay, yeah. You know. Was it the directional dice and the scatter dice?
No, they were just plain D6s. No, they're just plain D6s, but they're like from the era where like they had the exact same D6s in like all the Warhammer boxes and stuff.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
And they had like, they were kind of like on the smaller side.
Yeah, I actually like those tiny dice.
Yeah, they're great. Handy. And if you're rolling like fistfuls of like orc attack dice, you kind of need like the.
Yeah. Even in Spearhead, I had to have like 20 plus dice sometimes.
Yeah. Plus, you don't want them to have sharp edges if you're going to like grab like a whole big old handful. So those big Chessex dice will just cut your hands.
Yeah. And if you accidentally swallow one, it's going to hurt more if they're sharp.
Yeah. You want some rounded edges if it's coming out, the other end. So it's more of a gentle experience.
Yeah. So today's episode, despite the clickbait title, isn't about regular 5 parsecs from home.
Yeah, we fooled you. Pulled you in. Yeah. It's like one of those video game app or mobile game ads on that you see online where like the ad is for a game that doesn't exist.
Yeah, that's right. Or it does exist at the very first iteration and then they quickly get rid of all that once they have you hooked.
Yeah, I was watching a video about it the other day where a guy actually downloaded a bunch of those games, and it turns out now they do put that thing in the game, but it's like in a tutorial that then like never comes back.
Oh, yes.
Because all those games after you're done with that are just like generic, like build a base and steal your money bullshit.
Yeah.
So they'll have like a weird little like puzzle game first, and then like that never comes back again. But now, like, I'm sure they got, like, threatened by, like, the App Store, like, owners, like, Apple and Google for false advertising or something. Yeah, so they had to put it in.
Yeah. I mean, just enough is more than enough.
Yeah.
Let's see. Tom says, my dice have luxury residences. Wow. Sci-fi dice live in a cargo terrain piece. Fantasy live in a wooden chest. Hey.
Oh, that is awesome.
Yeah.
That is going above and beyond. I used to have, when we played a lot of Crossfire, I had sets of Allied and Axis dice that are like speckled green and speckled gray, which, you know, so it was kind of, and people would, when we played, like people would reach for the dice and then we realized they're picking up the wrong side's dice and they would like grab the other ones.
So for this show, what I wanted to do was get an idea of 5 parsecs from home tactics for people, because I think that's like one of the one that people kind of have more questions about, say, because 5 parsecs from home is very ubiquitous now. You can find million videos of quality varying.
Tactics is kind of like the sleeper game. Right? Yeah,
that's right. And I was hoping from you two elevator pitches. Yeah. One would be the elevator pitch for the people who already know 5 parsecs from Tactics, and one would be the people or the 5 parsecs from home, and then the other one would be the elevator pitch for people who do not know anything about 5 parsecs from home.
That's true. Which one makes the most sense to first?
I'd say 4 5 parsecs people, the fans of the game already. Yeah. Like, what are they buying into now?
Statistically, 100% of people listen to this video anyway.
Yeah.
I don't think we get that much stray traffic. Because it would just be incomprehensible, gibberish. So if you already know 5 parsecs from home and you have either not heard of Tactics yet or you've been eyeing it, but you're not really sure. So it's a couple of things. It's a standalone game for military actions, platoon level-ish. It's a way to take your existing, mostly bad guys that you painted up and paint a bit more. And then you have a little army. So if you have some mercenaries, you can build a couple more squads, a little mercenary force. It also acts as a bit of a toolbox. You can pull things into the regular 5 parsecs from home, or you can send your characters out and get a military career. So I guess that's an elevator pitch, right? I was from third floor to first.
Yeah, that's right. And then the next one would be people who want to play a war game. Why would they start with 5 parsecs from home Tactics when they've never touched the property whatsoever?
All right. So now we're starting at the fifth floor and going down to the lobby. Mm-hmm. So we got a little more time. You should pick Tactics if you are interested in a bit more of a freeform playstyle. There are point values and all that good stuff. There are scenarios, but you can also play with a game master the way that, the old dudes did back in the day. That's really the whole thing. There's a bunch of tools about creating your own scenarios, having things like rival characters, searching for things, unexpected things. There's off-map support, which can do a bunch of stuff. It's very open-ended and designed to be kind of a more creative approach. It's really meant to be scenario-driven. And you can play together if you want. You can play solo. You can also play with nobody at all. Then you just leave your miniatures and go eat lunch. But yeah, it's really the original pitch. And I don't know that this necessarily comes across that heavily in the marketing blurb. I didn't write this stuff. But the original pitch was that it was kind of like a return to scenario-driven miniatures gaming, which had kind of fallen by the wayside. There's always been the three ways to play, I guess, where it's kind of competitive. You build an army, I build an army, we meet up on Saturday and we play a game. That's the standard now. There's the warband solo randomly generated where you may or may not play solo. But you're kind of generating and playing through stuff. And then there's the scenario driven, which I think historical gamers have stuck to more. In sci-fi gaming, that used to be the norm, way back, and then it kind of fell away. You can blame Warhammer if you want. That's usually a safe bet. But where the GM creates a scenario, and then your army and my army, I'm ambushing your convoy of transports, and the GM figures out what that looks like, and then we set up and play a game, and maybe in the middle of it turns out one of the transports was full of bioweapons or something. So that's kind of just a different way of doing things and a way of appealing to a group of gamers that kind of hasn't been served that well, because this is not a common one these days. So yeah, that's kind of the, and since the standard 5 parsecs from home covers the procedural kind of warband style quite well, I don't know if we are technically the biggest for that right now, but we can pretend we are.
I don't think there's much for competition in the sci-fi.
For sci-fi, no. For fantasy, there's probably a lot more. It also depends, because I know everyone who plays 5 Leagues also plays Rangers. But I don't know that those are necessarily I guess they are. I'm mixing up Rangers and Frostgrave. I'm an idiot. Yeah. Rangers is probably still bigger. I think they've sold more at least. But yeah, Frostgrave is more Mordheim. It's the same. If you like one, you'll like the other. But they're not really the same thing specifically. Frostgrave is more my dudes and your dudes, and we fight it out.
Exactly.
But statistically, everyone who bought Leagues has probably played Frostgrave, right?
Or at least thought about it.
They played one of Frostgrave or Rangers. I think that's a pretty safe bet. They have certainly bought Frostgrave minis boxes.
Yeah. Oh, those are great. I love them.
Oh, God.
So we're going to go into that hard-hitting section, AI-generated question Yes. It actually worked out really well last time, and
I was surprised. They were pretty good. Now you did have to tweak a little bit, didn't you?
Yeah, like sometimes it just got a little bit too wordy.
Yeah, dramatic.
AI does.
Yeah, yeah, it can be. So you have to, and also these are unrehearsed. I have no idea what the questions were ahead of time.
Yeah, that's right.
So you're getting an authentic reaction.
So the first
means we can market it. That means we can label it as a reaction video.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Game designer shocked. So the first section is game design philosophy. So the book mentions adventure style wargaming, contrasting it with competitive style. How do you balance the narrative-driven player agency aspects of 5 Parsecs from Home Tactics with a need for clear rules and a tactical experience?
See, that's actually a pretty good question. That's a great question. You just kind of put some stuff in the book, and then if players complain that it doesn't work, then you tell them they're doing it wrong. So in a way, it's almost, and this was actually a problem with the, because you have a certain amount of page count. I don't remember how much it was, 50,000, 55,000, something like that. So there's only like, when you start doing things, if you want like a point system with army list, that's like a chunk of page or word count that you eat up. So now you have like only this much left. If you want a big section with scenario ideas, that takes a big chunk. Like, so the more things you try to do, you get less and less word count and space, essentially, like to spend on each of them, right? Mm-hmm. And to an extent, you have to just, the way I approach it was that each of these would be like components to it. So like the point system with the units. So you build your squads, and each squad type has like, there's all the different weapons, they all have points costs and stuff. And the idea was that if that works on its own, and the rules are simple enough that they can interface together. So like, if you sit down and play just a pickup game, we each build our platoons, we go fight, you know, one of the scenarios in the book. And that works okay. And then you have all the scenario stuff on the side, and that is all set to work okay on its own. Then hopefully when they interface, you will generally, because most people will come, I think a lot of people will do like, we'll build our armies using points, but then one of us, or maybe a third person, comes up with a scenario that we play. So it's like pick up play, but like with a little more like fun stuff, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think, basically the approach was to make each of them kind of work independently, and then because you can combine the pieces like a lot of different ways. So as opposed to like, I guess the opposite would be like this grand unified design scheme where like everything is initially built as a cohesive whole, but then you run into the problem that you can't pull parts out, and that wouldn't work here because it had to, like my goal with it was that it had to, if you want to pick up the book and just play like Warhammer, like a more tactical Warhammer in a less over the top setting, It, even though it may not be the best game for that, but it had to work like that. If you didn't want to do any of the scenario stuff, you just want to play like pickup games. Okay. It had to work like that. So you kind of have to go the other way. So
modularity.
Yes, modularity as a choice, because in this case, that is what fit the best. If you're doing it over with a very specific goal that it is always going to be, you know, scenario driven, it's always going to be, then you can do it differently, because then you can work towards that goal, because you don't have to worry about where the pickup play like works.
Okay, yeah. The next question, you state that the game is a toolbox for you to employ however you see fit. Can you elaborate on this design philosophy, or do you have an example of a player-created scenario or modification that particularly impressed you?
Not that much yet for player-created stuff, although stuff is starting to come out. We were just talking to a guy on the Discord who came up with this really like detailed mini system for like recovering like wounded troopers and having to like drag them around and recover them a certain amount of time and stuff. So that was really cool. Yeah, the modularity, you can kind of, there's different ways to do it. What I found like over the years is that telling people that they're welcome to make their own stuff is not very effective in getting people to make their own stuff. Because if you haven't sat and, like for me, not because I'm a huge genius brain, but just because I've spent the time working with the game system, it's all very logical what you can and do and what won't work. But if you didn't do that, you have to pick that up, right? You have to spend the time. So a lot of people are, I think a lot of people are hesitant. They don't want to like write a scenario that then is garbage because they didn't understand how certain things work. Now it's a bad experience for their friends.
Mm-hmm.
If you give people like a list of things as a starting point, if you give them like five different ideas, then suddenly, because now you can look at those ideas and say, okay, if that's like suggestions for how it could work, I could do it in a bunch of other ways, but now I know kind of like where the starting point is, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's like when, was it on stream we talked about like putting starter armies in books, or was that on the Discord? I don't remember. But it's like,
I think it was on stream at least once. Yeah.
Yeah. It's come up where like it's really helpful. And I forget about it all the time because you can see like what an army ought to look like, you know, like, okay, I need kind of around this. And then you can go build and stuff. So you're not wondering if your first game is like way too large because you don't know what you're doing. And then the game is or it's way too small and the game is boring because you don't have enough dudes.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
we got a listener question here from Von Comp.
Oh, we got two actually.
Yeah, yeah. Would 5 parsecs work well for Black Ops missions? And then those teams could also feature in tactics games. And a follow-up. Also, would it be possible to transition between both systems in the same scenario, or is this not needed?
So there are stealth rules in parsecs. Okay, so I'm just going to say parsecs when I mean 5 parsecs from home, and tactics when I mean tactics. That's like the easiest way.
Yeah.
Because otherwise the naming convention gets stupid. There are stealth rules in tactics, and you can, if you're familiar with, or not in tactics, oh my fucking God. See, this is the problem. There are stealth rules in From Home. And if you're familiar with From Home, obviously the scenarios are very open-ended. We don't really tell you why something is happening. That's like up to you, right? So yes, you could have, in your narrative, and you can pick out, like, make sure you're facing, like, military enemies or security guards or something. Yeah, in your narrative, that could be a Black Ops mission. And then you could feed the result of that back into, like, the tactics, like, campaign system. So you might get a bonus for carrying out a successful raid or something that gives you a bonus in the how the campaign rules work there. Transition between systems in the same scenario is not really needed. They're both fully, like, standalone. Here's the thing. What tactics does is it adds additional elements on top for things like troops being like suppressed by fire, stuff like that, off-map support. If you're playing kind of like man-to-man, you typically don't want or need that. That's kind of off the... It's like people always ask if they can like use tanks in the 5 parsecs from home. I'm like, yeah, you can use the tactics rules for tanks and they'll work because they're fully compatible. But like your 5 dudes aren't going to fight a tank. Like you're just going to be a speed bump on the path too. So yes, it is all compatible for people who want to do stuff like that. But by and large, I think you're better off like just running the two games like side by side. So you do the military level stuff in tactics. And then if you want to like Black Ops raids or stuff like that, you can use From Home. I imagine a lot of people also just like pick the version of each thing they like best and like mix and match them up.
Mm-hmm. All right, sweet. So the next question from the robots is, you use the term directed scenario gaming to describe the primary style of play.
Yeah.
What do you see as a key difference between this style and a more traditional tabletop RPG with miniatures?
Yeah. Well, for one, it's trademarkable, if you call it that. So that's very important. certainly, that's important to the overlords. I don't think that's a trademark. It was basically a way of just saying scenario-driven gaming, but in a very specific way. That it's about, creating scenarios, but like in an open-ended fashion to it. So I'm going to pull up the actual definition here.
Okay.
Which is, there are two features. The first is that it is a scenario that has been purposefully created as opposed to one that you randomly generate, or a generic scenario. So like a lot of games have a setup sequence for like you set up 24 inches apart and you set up some objectives and you do this. That's not a directed scenario. And if you randomly generated like 5 parsecs from home, that it has to be something that you sit down and create. And the second thing is that the scenario is actively being run by a person. That could be a game master. It could be one of the players. You could even run it like together. But like you're making decisions about the scenario rather than it's just what the rule book says happens. So that's a difference. It basically means that somebody is actively like coming up with a scenario and creating one. And that's really what a lot of the tools in the book are for, creating that kind of thing. Because a lot of the stuff in there in the book doesn't make any sense in like a PvP scenario, because you wouldn't necessarily have like two characters in an army that like one of them starts plotting against the other or something like that. Like it would be complete chaos. So you have a person who can make decisions, who can... Sometimes you can make the decisions up front. You create the scenario, you set it up, and then you can just kind of like watch what happens. Or you can make the decisions during the scenario if you have hidden things and monsters that pop up or whatever. Like it can be whatever you want. But it's basically to signify that the scenario is an intentional thing that you're playing as opposed to just, you know, a randomly generated like system or something.
Okay.
So it's a little bit of marketing guff, but there's some logic behind it.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it clarifies it pretty well. The last question in that section then will be, the rule book includes optional rules such as individual actions and strict overwatch. How do you recommend players decide which optional rules to use, and how do you ensure the core game remains balanced regardless of the chosen options?
That is an excellent question, because that's a hobby horse of mine. So the default for any game I write is always that the options are not assumed. They are options for a reason. Because one thing that always pissed me off when I was a kid was reading a game, and there would be a bunch of stuff that lists as advanced rules, but then it turns out that like the entire game assumes you're playing with all that shit, so you have to learn it anyway. So like if you just play like the first 12 pages of the book, you are basically like never going to be able to play the game. So I was pretty heavily against that. So no, if anything is listed as optional, it was not assumed to be part of the base game. The base game is always just what it says. The options are, a lot of times the options are places where there were two different ways of doing something, and one of them, sometimes you just have to pick one. Sometimes one is like a little easier and the other thing is a little more work, or sometimes like I want a specific experience, but I realized there would be a sizable amount of people who wanted it differently. So like strict overwatch is one of those where like a lot of people might not like how it works. So here's a easy option you can use to tailor the game a little bit. Sometimes I just like putting an extra option.
Yeah.
But yeah, they're never intended. Like the intended experience is always without that. It doesn't matter whether there's some options I would like to use and some I wouldn't. That doesn't matter. Like the intention is that you play the game without the options and then you can choose. Now, if you want to throw them all in, that's fine. Like you do whatever you want to do.
Can you put in too many options, would you say? Or is it really up to the player?
You can, because at some point, if there's too many of them, people just don't use any of it because it becomes overwhelming. So in that case, you're better off putting it. Now, you can put it in an appendix. Nobody reads those, so you can put a bunch of crap back there if you want. So there's there's a very like specific kind of player who loves extra options because they are buying the book just to like marvel at the rules. So you can make them happy, but in that case, you usually, if it's like a lot, just put it in the back or in an extra thing or something. I think it's easy for a section because when you're reading through it, your brain is going to automatically assume that you also have to memorize all the options, even if you don't, because you might not use them. So keep it pretty tight.
Our next section is going to be on world building and lore.
Hey.
The setting of Unified Space is described as gritty space opera with complex political situations, such as two major powers fighting a war on one world while allied on another. Is there a real world or fictional inspiration for this political landscape?
Not specifically, but it was kind of the absolute origin of the setting was this idea that if you had a like human empire that stretches the stars like you always do, then logically it would be like a gigantic mess to keep track of, because no matter how you communicate, by the time like a thing happens on planet A and that travels like across star systems, by the time that reaches like the other side of the galaxy, there might have been like years passed, and like that war you started is already over and you're now friends out here. But now the news have reached the other side of the galaxy, so now they're going to war with the same dudes who are confused about why we catching strays. So a lot of it was this idea, like, okay, if you actually have galactic civilizations, they would be so big and unwieldy that everyone is just making decisions on their own. So you could have like unity in a different race, like being allied in one place and fighting an invasion, but at a different location, like, they have no idea that's happening, because, you know, so they're just doing their own thing and they might be at war with each other instead. So that was kind of the idea, that it's just so unwieldy and so massive that and then, like, I'm not, like, world building is not, like, something I'm an expert at or anything, but I always thought, like, you kind of set down, like, what's the core bits of your setting, and then a lot of things kind of follow from that. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of the logic with that. And then it just became like a unique thing, or which would be kind of interesting. So it makes it a little more. Plus, it works well for gaming because you can kind of do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep it flexible. Strict lore, like, isn't very fun.
It can be, but it's like a very specific kind of fun.
Yeah. Like I hate the idea that Warhammer is just like depressing all the time, 100% of the time. It's never, ever good.
Yeah. People have come up with like their own versions of it where it's like less garbage.
Yeah.
But it's like with Battletech, like, you could basically, like, there's probably as much written about Battletech as there is about, like, the Napoleonic Wars. So if you want to go, but you can still just, like, buy a box of mechs and say, like, these are my dudes and we're gonna fight. Like, you don't need to know any of that shit. You can if you like. So it's a very specific kind of, like there's a certain kind of fan who, like, super likes all that stuff. I think I said it before, when I've pulled it online, uses like a third of the Parsec players use the setting, and a third will use like some of it, or they'll mix it with like their own stuff.
Yeah.
So you get a lot of like, well, isn't it funny that like the Star Wars Empire and Unity kind of work the same, have the same uniforms kind of thing.
Yeah. It's kind of similar.
Yeah. So if you want, but yeah. And then a third will just, there's like Star Trek or whatever. So it doesn't matter.
And the next question is, the timeline mentions several major events in wars, like the Hegemony War and the Horde Dominion War. How did these large-scale historical events influence the small-scale tabletop battles that players experience?
Well, that's an easy question, because they didn't. the game system the game system existed first, and then at some point I sat down and wrote out a timeline.
Yeah.
So it's actually the other way around, because when you have things like, you have the Kryn that are renowned for being belligerent and fighting with everybody. So then I put, if you read the timeline, you'll notice that every time like a new race is discovered, immediately afterwards, the Kryn goes to fight them just to get it out of their systems. Or, you know, like the Soulless, the robot dudes have, I think it's established somewhere that they showed up at some point to the galaxy and they're kind of newcomers. So, you know, okay. So then they need to have a point where they show up and start like, so it's the other way around, that what was already created in the game, that sort of influenced the timeline backwards. And then sometime when you get to do a timeline, you just get to come up with like neat, weird stuff. And you get to come up with like cool names of stuff, which is one of my favorite things, is just naming things that allude to stuff and leaving players like wondering if it's, if there's anything there, or if it's just a name for something.
Yeah.
You once ruled the realms with dice and a sword, painted goblins till tea, then your minis were stored. You grew up, got a job, bought a flat, wore a tie, swapped dragons for deadlines, your brushes went dry. Now the dishes are done and the kids are in bed. You climb to the attic to raise the undead. Crack open the paints that you swore you'd outgrown. The smell of acrylic, it feels like your home. There's grey in your beard, even more on your head, but you're splashing some colour on plastic and lead. So welcome back, General. What took you so long? Your hobby's still here. It's the place you belong. The Bedroom Battlefields Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. Find it at bedroombattlefields.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
And this kind of ties into the next question too. Species like the Soulless, Converted, and Horde each have unique origins and motivations. Can you discuss the process of creating the lore of these factions, ensuring they are distinct in their tabletop mechanics?
Well, the easy answer is that you play a bunch of Quake 2 and Mass Effect, and then you just take all that shit. Yeah. There's kind of a mix, because you get... some of them are very obviously inspired by things in popular science fiction. You know, like, it's not a super big surprise that like the Soulless are basically like the Geth from Mass Effect. So in those cases, you take like the idea, but then you like change it up or modify it. So like the schemes and plans that the Soulless have, or have nothing to do with like how the Geth are in Mass Effect. Sometimes it's just like, it's a very vague idea because we are playing a miniatures game. So like the one of the minor races, the Hakshan, only exists because I thought that it would be cool to use like Fire Warrior 40k minis because they just look real cool. So I wrote a race that has nothing to do with how Tau work or how Tau are in 40k. But they were just in my head, they would be using that mini. So that's why they're there. Like the Hulkers are there because I thought people would want to use like Space Orc models, but maybe like repainted in more human skin colors. So I was like, okay, well, in that case, we need like a big, like genetically engineered, like dumb dude. So sometimes, especially for a minis game, because you can obviously just be driven by like the miniatures. A few of the races are like created specifically for the game, and luck. Again, because it's a miniatures game first, usually the game function comes in. So we have like, there's a bunch of different, you know, like the vent crawlers and swarm and stuff are just there to have like creepy crawlies to like fight that won't ever like talk to you. So, which is different if you're doing a role playing game. Obviously, you need to kind of start with all of the like society and things because you have to play them as people and characters. But for a miniatures game, we're starting from the they're over there with two attack dice and that's your starting point.
A question AI would never ask is, do you have a favorite child?
I only have one, so technically yes. Otherwise, he's going to be pretty sad.
Yeah. For the five parts
in the game. yeah, that was weird. I try not to. For player races, the one I'm like most pleased with is the Swift, the little winged. Lizards. They're technically inspired by the drawing, but they're a little different. But we managed to sneak because they have a whole thing about how they're like, they can see into the time and dimensions and stuff, which is why they act kind of weird. So in the Five Leagues book, there's actually a Easter egg in one of the drawings, sort of insinuating that, oh, maybe the Swift like actually can travel through like dimensions and time. So, and I think we got an Easter egg into one of the upcoming books as well. I don't think we were able to put one in Forgotten Ruin because that was all, none of that was custom art. That was all like their art they already had. So that's probably my favorite. As far as like monsters and enemies, honestly, like just some of the mercenary units, because I think the idea of like an squad of soldiers that has like a specific identity, like it's these assholes again, feels very like television, you know, like these guys show up again, you know it's gonna be a bad time. So, but yeah, nothing like super clever.
And then to wrap up the section, the document notes that a force's appearance can be quite motley with kitbash and out-of-date vehicles. How's this aesthetic choice inform the game's design, and what advice do you have for players who want to reflect this in their miniatures collection?
So again, this is where it's the other way around. Mm-hmm. The starting point is that we knew we were not going to have army-specific army lists. So there was not going to be a Solus list and a Corin list and a Unity list. There was going to be one army list, which has... It has points cost for all the different troops, but or races, but it has like specific squad types that are everyone uses those, and it has specific weapons, and everyone uses those. So when that's the starting point, then you have to go back and say, okay, well in that case, you because there's not really a lot that prevents you from having like kind of whatever you want. All the points costs are open ended, so you can use if you want to take a squad type and like swap out the weapons for a different weapon that's not on that roster. You can do that as long as, you know, in a pickup game, you have to get your opponent to agree if you want to do that or not. Mm-hmm. So, and the same with vehicles. So if that's the case, your armies are kind of going to be a bit mixed and could potentially have any kind of kit. Then that means that your armies might end up looking kind of ragged. And then that seeps into how the setting works that, you know, vehicles are, if you have a corporation selling tanks or something, they'll sell to anybody as long as you can pay. So you can have human tanks, in quotation marks, show up in any army because they could have bought them or stolen them or captured them or they could have been military aid or something. So it's the same as before where the tabletop results were actually the primary thing and then it feeds back into it. If the tabletop game looks like this and people like to build weird armies, then it means that that is how armies work.
Mm-hmm. Perfect. The next part will be mechanics and systems. The AI solo combat system is designed with a lighter touch and guidelines rather than strict flowcharts. What are the challenges of creating an AI that feels intelligent but isn't overly burdensome to a single player to manage?
The challenges are massive. I think we've been talking about it before. Because here's the thing. You need a way of understanding this tank is active now and it needs to do something. So now if you take a tank and put it on like a table next to a couple of buildings, even for just moving, let's say ignore whether or not it moves. We say it's going to move. It has, it can move in almost any direction. Once you take the terrain in, there's some place it can't go. But it might have like 20 different directions. And if it has a movement of up to 12 inches, it could move it up, that's already like hundreds of possibilities. And that's just for it moving. So you will absolutely go insane trying to like automate all that. A computer can do that. But that's not what we're doing. So there is this very wide gap between, if you tell a player that in this situation, the tank is going to move towards an objective, but not within 6 inches of buildings containing troops or something like that. That's an example. Then the player can usually figure, okay, well, if it's moving towards an objective, there's two. So it's going one of these directions. And one of these directions is going to take it close to buildings containing enemy troops. So it only has one choice now. So you kind of pin yourself down. Or the same as like some rules will say that like, troops that are fired at will shoot at the unit that shot at them, which feels realistic, but it also just removes a bunch of choices. Instead of 12 different units you can see, you're shooting back at that one. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of solo games do have flowchart systems, and the Parsec systems kind of are a flowchart. They're just more conversational. So it's like, if in this situation, do this. If not, then do the other thing. The big, some people love random solo stuff where like an enemy unit will move in a random fashion, or they'll have a table they roll on to see what they do. I personally, when I play, I just don't want to roll dice for like every fucking guy on there.
Yeah.
If I have 10 enemy squads, because a lot of times it's like obvious what they should do anyway. If they're out in the open and are currently being shot to shit, they should move to some goddamn cover. It doesn't make sense that if I roll for them, then they will be, they might decide to stand around and like start, making their lunches. But it's also, at some point, it's like one of those things where once you're like made a decision, then you're kind of like stuck with it. So like Parsecs and Leagues, 5X, I guess, I initially chose that the AI was not going to be random, then it's stayed that way. Mm-hmm. And we've added there was some tables in one of the Parsecs expansions that gives you some random functions to it. We've come back to that idea a few times, but The core idea was that the AI is just deterministic. If in this situation, here's what it'll do, but keeping kind of open-ended so people can interpret a little bit. Because again, if I tell you, and this is like where you get to cheat a little bit, because if I tell you that this unit should move towards cover, but try to fire at the enemy. That's like a typical thing. Mm-hmm. You can look at the table and see, oh, okay, obviously that means they move over here, so they still can see, as opposed to setting it that, you would move exactly like 7 inches in a forward direction. Like, it's easy to just get. By fudging it a little bit and letting players like fill in the blanks, that usually produces like a decent result. You should put Tom's comment on the screen because he said nice things.
Let's see. Oh, Tom's always found the 5P enemy AI very elegant and fluid. But really, that's a reflection on the user themselves.
Absolutely. That's because you were a elegant and fluid person.
Yeah. You are an edgelord who always wants to win, then the 5P AI will never stand up to that.
Exactly. It will always throw its guns down and walk backwards slowly towards you.
No thanks. I'm out. I was thinking about it when I was going through all the 5 Parsecs from Home second edition stuff. So I always kind of miss the player morale that was in the beginning. Versions. I always kind of like the idea that maybe your guys are just going to book it no matter what you say.
Yeah, it's one of those things where not having it was, and I think by the end of second edition maybe had gone, I don't remember when it left. But it's one of those things where like, there's two ways you can do that. You can either have player morale or you cannot have it. And
yeah.
At some point, you pick one of them, and then that's just how it is now.
Yeah. I think it was the right decision, but I always kind of like that idea.
So, yeah, like, yeah,
like, no,
I like it
down here.
I like it too, but it's also the kind of thing that, like, people would probably moan about. So, I don't know. Like, definitely. In the end, that could be literally, like, it could be either way, and sometimes you just have to pick the one that goes. People sometimes ask, like, how do you decide, like, you know, which is the optional rule or which is, like, in an expansion, which isn't? It's like, sometimes there's just two ways of doing it. You just have to pick one. Like, it's like you're making a sandwich. You have ham and turkey.
Like,
you
got, but if you really like the other one, that's when you put in the optional rules.
Yeah. Sometimes you want to, maybe I do want turkey, but not today. Yeah. Today is a ham day.
These are the hams. All right. The next question will be, the operational system provides a high-level strategic layer for campaigns. How did you design this system to be both engaging and simple, avoiding the excessive detail that can sometimes bog down large-scale campaign game?
That is true. Mostly by just not allowing... So the way the campaign works, for those who aren't familiar yet, it's very... You basically take sort of a grand picture. You have a number of areas on your map that you kind of pencil in. That's where everyone is fighting, and you have strength in those areas. But you don't keep track of, like... If you have, like, 3 points of strength and they have two, that might mean that you have, like, 30 guys and they have 20, or it might mean you have, like, three divisions and they have two. It doesn't matter. All that matters is that you have one more point of strength than they do. So all of that, anything below that, like, imagine if you're reading in the newspaper in the future, like the hyper paper.
Yeah.
Like, they're not going to tell you that there's 242 tanks in that army. They're just going to tell you that, you know, these forces are having... You know, they're kind of winning in that area. So all of the detail and tracking and stuff, that is strictly on, like, your troops that you're keeping track of and carrying over from game to game. So they can gain experience and they can die and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But anything beyond that, we're just focused on, like, how strong are you in each of these areas? And then that's the focus on. So zooming, like, all the way out. Because I played, like, in a lot of... I think everyone has done this, but especially when you're younger, where you, like, draw the map and you build, like, 200 Warhammer armies. You put them all on the map.
Yeah.
And you move them all, like, one space at a time, and then, like, 2 weeks later, nobody wants to play anymore. You got, like, one game out of it. Because it was... yeah. Somebody loses their army roster, or you mix up the armies or something, or somebody is fucking around, and they have Titans in all their armies or something. So, that stuff is wonderful, but that was, like, the wrong vibe here. So, you can still come up with stuff like that. But yeah, so it's very abstract on purpose to force you to just not have to worry about that.
Okay, so you think it keeps up the flow much better that way?
Yeah, in this case, because we're still trying to have, like, some, like, story to it. Like,
all right, so the next question will be, suppression is a key mechanic in the combat rules, representing how units under fire are hindered. Why did you choose this specific approach for suppression, where it's tied to non-damaging hits, and what impact do you feel it has on tactical decision-making?
Yeah, so the point of suppression in the game is that when you get shot at, you are less keen. Like, people don't want to be shot. When they do get shot, they will tend to keep their heads down and not shoot all that well. So the way it works in the game, you can do different games will do this in a bunch of different ways. But the way I ended up going with it is that you count the number of hits the unit took, which did not produce casualties. So if a unit lost two guys, you take two hits, two guys die. You actually don't get suppressed. Now, the guys who are dead are, like, quite suppressed. But the rest of them are not. If you took two hits and nobody died, you would have two guys suppressed. So it's kind of... it's sort of looking at, like, if you count the casualties as being permanently suppressed, because they could be in a campaign game, those guys aren't necessarily dead, but they're just hitting the dirt or, you know, whatever, permanently. You can't rally them back. So it kind of makes sense that way. It just feels a little counterintuitive because we're used to the idea that, like, taking casualties, like, affects morale, but morale is a separate thing from the suppression.
Okay.
When your squad is active, the number of suppression markers they have is the number of guys who will only hit on sixes, regardless of, like, their skills or bonuses or anything else. So it's kind of simple. It just makes it more difficult for you to firebag effectively. So in a heated fight, the other effect is that if you have really tough troops, like good armor or high toughness, they will tend to take a lot of hits that don't kill them. So they will be suppressed because they keep, like, you know, dudes have like bullets bouncing off their helmets and stuff.
Yeah. It's like a shell off the tank is still pretty
stuff. Yeah, like if you might get a you might need a change of underwear, but your tank is fine. Like if it went through, then you're not fine, but you have a different set of concerns. So it's basically it's a case where somebody very clever once said it's like deciding for effect, where like the end result works even if the step by step is not necessarily like specifically accurate.
Okay.
So
gotcha. The Von Kamp has some questions. Will a future expansion allow for us to add super heavy vehicles?
Big ass tanks, probably. I don't know if they would be on the size of like Bane Blades and like 40k, because that's like real fucking big. Probably. I know we've talked about having a thing to play like even larger games, kind of like our version of like Apocalypse 40k. Okay. So yeah, possibly. I don't know if it's like real high on the priority. It just depends. The priority list like changes over time.
And we got consider this a formal request for a quick reference sheet.
Yes, I know. We kind of screwed up on not creating one, so I'll see what I can have done.
You just got to have Chris on retainer. He does the best quick reference sheets.
Yeah. It also may be one of those things where it's easier for like fans to make one.
Yeah.
Because otherwise, if I'm having the overlords make one, then that means like somebody has to get paid to do all the layout and stuff, which doesn't take long, but it's still something. And it has to. It's really that. Contest. Yeah, exactly.
Painting contest. Never mind that. We got a quick reference contest.
Yeah, that's a real shit. The other thing is that it has to fit in like a, you know, like the layout guy has like a bunch of projects like lined up behind him. So
yeah,
getting like one little thing fitting in randomly.
And then to wrap up our suppression stuff, having played a scenario the other day, the suppression mechanic is excellent.
Thank you. So yeah, it worked. So sometimes you write down a rule and then like when you play it, you realize like, oh shit, that was actually really good. Like, that's not always like, you know, if you write enough, you will have like a pretty keen idea of like what'll work or what won't. But sometimes like you can still be surprised that like, you know, something works out really well.
Yeah. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
The final question in the mechanics and systems section is, the campaign progression system uses campaign points for CP for unit upgrades and other advantages. How did you balance the cost of these upgrades to ensure that a losing player isn't penalized to the point of a death spiral?
Yeah, that's always tricky because some people do want a death spiral. fundamentally, it is... so the way they're awarded is when you play a campaign game. So we're assuming we're both playing against each other. We're each rolling dice. We roll three dice, drop the lowest of the dice, and add the other two. If the scenario used victory points, then you just get extra points based on the amount of victory points. Otherwise, it's like a fixed, like 3 points if you won, 1 point if you were lost. So the difference in winning and losing is not that great. Like in a typical, if you win the game, you get 3 more points than what you roll. If I lose, then I get 1 more point than what I roll. So they're kept very close to each other, which over a very long time, they could compound. But because a lot of the things you can buy are like fairly minor, and some of them are individual advantages that you can, like being able to like go first or second in the first round of the game is, you know, that's a cool little thing to have, but it's not really like gonna overthrow everything, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, mostly just by ensuring that the points are fairly close to each other. So you get a... You have to give people a little bit of an edge for winning, because otherwise, you know, there's no point. And you have to tempt players enough that they'll risk their units and stuff. But yeah, it's just keeping the point kind of tight so that, again, you could argue that maybe it should be bigger or smaller. The other thing, though, is that campaign points are a little nebulous. You can choose to, because you can treat them two ways. You can have campaign points that are specific to an army. So while I'm playing my mercenaries, I earn campaign points for that army. But you could also set it up that the campaign points are for the player. So even if you switch, because one of the things that can happen in the campaign is that you are now playing a different army or even switching sides.
Okay.
Like you are now playing a different force in the campaign if you want to go with that. In that case, if your campaign points are for the player, they just go with you. Like, you earn the point, and now you have some extra two for this new army to get started with it. If you're doing it army specific, then all of that shit stays with the old army. So it's
like a commander of renown system.
I bring
my prestige with me.
Yeah, like your karma or whatever.
So the final section will be crossover and community. Tactics is described as a fully compatible with 5 parsecs from home. What was the most difficult aspect of ensuring seamless crossover? So that's one of those AI words.
Well, that's, in this case, that's a good thing, because seamless is not going to fucking happen. So if you take the look at just like the number of equipment items in from home, there, I don't know how many there are. There's probably like 80, including weapons and stuff. So if you take that number of possible items interacting with each other and that number of character abilities and enemy abilities and scenario, like, you will find stuff that isn't going to line up. That is inevitable. The biggest example is actually the weapons table. Tactics has its own. They're the same weapons, although not every weapon carries over. There's no, you know, some weapons just aren't relevant on an army scale. And of course, there's new heavy weapons and stuff. But some weapons do have different stats in tactics to suit their kind of battlefield scale. So some weapons are actually more powerful in tactics, because when you're shooting like a, like there's the, I think it's called the Fury rifle, which is like the anti-tank, like energy rifle. And in 5 parsecs from home, you're just shooting at like a dumbass robot or like a big monster. But like, it's kind of at personal scale. So we can say it's not as powerful because they can kind of jump out of the way, or you blasted apart a bulkhead or something. But on an army scale, you need that weapon to blow up like an actual APC or something, or an even bigger robot or an even dumber space monster. So it can be more powerful because now the scale has been like zoomed out. Like, everything in from home has to be on a personal scale because your characters are dudes or dudettes. Not all dudes are dudes. So everything, all the monsters, everything has to exist on a scale where the opposition is a guy with a pistol and like a wrench, you know? So there's a limit to how much you can like wrench your way through. But in tactics, it can be a big ass tank fighting like a big ass monster. So everything zooms out and gets bigger. So in this case, after a while, I decided we're just going to redo the weapons tables to be tactics appropriate. And then if you are carrying characters back and forth, you're just going to have to choose. So you might say, I'll use the from home stats in that game and the tactics stats in the other game. Or you might stick with one of them and use them for both. You can do it whatever you want. That is on you. But yeah, that was an example where like things don't translate specifically. Because one of the absolute original decisions was that there would be bigger units, big monsters and like vehicles. In tactics, that was like day zero, like decision.
Most demanded feature.
Yes, absolutely. Also, tanks or vehicles specifically.
All right. So the book encourages players to provide feedback and ideas via email. What role does community feedback play in the development of your games? And how have players' ideas already shaped your work?
That's a great question, and one I should answer very carefully. That one, like, you're going to get a lot of feedback just writing, and that's good. But the feedback is going to be indifferent. You're going to have feedback that is really good. Sometimes that's like spotting errors, because like you're just going to miss stuff, or something is going to be mucked up, or something goes wrong in like the editing. Most of the time, it's my fault. So, but you're also going to get, sometimes people will see like the ideas you have, they'll just have the like the thing that sounds so obvious that, oh, of course you can do that with this, but you never think of it because there's just so only so many things you can think of. Or people will have ideas for like new things you could do. And those are all really cool. They might influence like some things that are in the some of the expansions and stuff. Was coming from people who suggested it or people who had ideas or even just people who requested it. Like a lot of the difficulty settings in from home are from people who just wanted more difficulty. It's like, okay, well, then how could you do that? And then you come up with something. Some feedback will be stuff that is good, but like in a different thing. So like a lot of people ask for stuff, like we talked before about like more random AI options. And that's not really the Parsec vibe, but you know, it could be as an option, or it could be in a different game or something. Because sometimes you take it and you kind of like put it to the side and you can come back to it. A lot of people will ask for like games that are, you know, like cowboy 5 parsecs or something. Like,
yeah.
Or, you know, some of those are like, I will, if people ask enough for something, I will finally relent, but I will try to resist as long as possible. Sometimes it's like the weasel tech thing where I kept saying no until I finally realized how to do it that I would enjoy. And then like it happened.
Yeah.
Or like fantasy KPS was like a joke before it became a game.
Yeah.
You know, so sometimes it's stuff like that where you kind of like, especially for, here's the thing. And I'm going to try and phrase this without sounding like a dickhead. But like, if you're a creative person who writes, you already have more ideas than you have time to make. Mm-hmm. So ideas that people give you are only going to go if that's an idea that you already kind of had in mind, or you think that creating this for people would be really worthwhile. It's like there was a musician like a couple of years ago who said that when he writes songs, like half the songs he writes for himself and the other songs he writes because he thinks fans would like it.
Okay.
Yeah. So, which I think is pretty.
That's really cool.
So, you know, you gotta do stuff that you're interested in doing yourself. And then you also have to, like, obviously, if you're trying to pay your bills, you have to also create some stuff that people are interested in. When you have a little bit of success, you get to the point where people will just kind of go with your dumb ideas. So you have more freedom with it. And then you have the last third of ideas, which are just like, you know, stuff that you say, oh, thank you for your feedback, and you move on because it's either stupid or it's just stuff you're not interested in doing. Like, I will never say never, but I'll probably never make a superhero game. That doesn't mean that if you ask about it, that's like a bad thing, but it's like the amount of stuff that I would have to like get on board with in a way that I think would be fun is so big that that's probably not one you should like sit up waiting for. There's a lot of other things that I would
probably be ponying up a lot of cash for that to happen.
Yeah, I mean, a big fat check will do it, but
nice.
You know, if people want to cough up some, I don't know if you're like supposed to say what you get paid for doing like contract work, but if people want to pony up something in the vicinity of 11 cents a word, I'll write whatever you ask me to.
Nice. So let's see here. We got, for players coming from the original 5 Parsecs from Home who want to start a tactics campaign, what is the single most important piece of advice you would give them to get started?
Use your existing minis. If you've already built stuff for bad guys, look at what you got and what you can easily. If you have like 2 squads of mercenaries or soldier dudes, then add another squad and a tank to them. Because then you get to use minis you've already built and you're already like halfway there. That was like one of the things we talked about when I originally pitched tactics, that people could scale up stuff they had already built and they would already be en route to an army. So it's like, oh, maybe I should buy like a tank or two. And then, you know, once you get collecting, then it follows itself.
Perfect. Looking ahead, the designer notes mention the possibility of future expansions with new weapons, scenarios, or advanced systems. Is there a particular area you are most excited to explore in the future of 5 Parsecs for Home Tactics?
Well, given that expansion 1 is out, I would say that new weapons and scenarios is very high on that list.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I think we'll leave that one as like a teaser for the next episode.
Yeah, that's right. So,
but we knew when the book was done and I was handing it over and showing it to the overlords, one of the things was that there was very little gear in the book. You have so many words and you have to spend them on something. So yes. Scenario stuff and tools were more important. So I knew that if we got to do an expansion, I would want it to be gear like oriented.
Okay. And we could, originally I had like a whole slew of questions for the expansion, but I think we're both out of time for the most part.
So yeah, maybe time is
just a little elevator pitch for why, if you love 5 Parsecs from Home Tactics, you'd want the Commander's Field Guide.
What you would guess, just off the top of my head, because there's a lot in that book. Tons of new weapons and gear. Oh my God, look at this asshole. He is. You got lunch, dumbass. Yeah, look pretty for the camera. There are tons of weapons and stuff like different grenade types and cannon ammunition. There are a bunch of scenarios, including smaller ones, and one specifically for pickup play. there's a bunch of lore. If you are one of the people who are into the lore, you can get the fearsome truth behind the Horde and the Solus, actually. And there's a bunch of other little things. So there's some new unit types for, like, I think there's a little section like Unity militias and stuff like that. So
yeah,
if you're a lore hound, there's a bunch of cool stuff in there. If you're a gear hound, there's a bunch of gear in there. And some of it is like weird stuff. So experiment with it. It's still,
so if you like the weird stuff, then that's the one.
Yeah, we were trying to balance it out between like the player versus player stuff, which is like a lot of the weapons and stuff, you know, new ways of blowing up their dudes, but also make sure that it was still like scenario friendly. So it's like when we talked about like this, like the different ways of playing this, like playing with the game master, playing kind of on your own, playing like player versus player pickup game. So this is like focusing on like a couple of those aspects instead of trying to do all of them because it's an expansion. Sure. So yeah. And again, some things were put in just to get people like building and painting stuff because people love an excuse to go out and buy like new minis. Right?
That is 100% true.
So when you see like new robot infantry or something, people will go like buy new robots.
Bleep bloops. My dude. Mm-hmm. Bleep bloops. Von Kump said, boarding actions would be so cool. Would you say that Tactics can do this well out of the box?
Pretty well. I feel like the one thing you would want is like something for, I don't actually remember if there's a scenario rule for like zero oxygen environments or something. Maybe it's even in there. Yeah, you could do okay. The big challenge with boarding actions, I don't think it's actually the rules. It's that fighting in corridors can do weird things to your gaming table because you, by definition, have choke points. If you set up your table so that there are multiple paths to get to places, like look at how space hold boards tend to work. They're not really realistic places, but they do usually have more than one way of getting from point A to point B. Because otherwise you will get into this situation where like it's very easy to like lock down a corridor. It's just dudes shooting at each other from the doors.
Yeah, yeah. Makes sense.
Oh my god, Cat.
He like highly recommends Field Guide as well. Lots of cool stuff. Loves the entries on drop troops.
Yes. Those were a fun addition. To add, and it was one of those where because we don't really do like army specific army lists, but it was fun to add like examples of what specific units look like in the setting. That's something I definitely want to do more of later.
Nice.
So that was next, just an example of that.
Yeah, I think that gives a pretty good wrap up of why people should buy 5 Parsecs from Home Tactics and probably the expansion too.
They should definitely do both, and if you want more expansions, then you should definitely buy the first one. That's how it goes. Everything is based on what sells, right?
I once bought an expansion first. I just had the expansion. I'm like, okay, well, I can't do anything with this. I just read through it and absorb the lore, but
yeah.
There's not much I can do.
Yeah. Sometimes it's, I feel like that happened a lot back in the day. You got like your grandma knows that you're into those games, but she doesn't really know like what those games are or what goes together. So now you have like a book for a game you don't play.
Yeah, or you want into a system and you just buy whatever you can afford. So you just get the cheapest one is an expansion.
Yeah. So it's like buying comic books, but your local comic book store never has issue like 1, 2, or 3.
Yeah.
So you start with 4 and like wonder which of these characters you're supposed to know already. So yeah, so that's all in the vibe.
Yeah, and we'll do the same thing with this episode as I did with the previous one, where we'll just cut out the section that describes tactics. I'll release it on its own. And if people want to share it to get other people excited about tactics, they can do so.
Yeah. So, and hopefully we can start seeing some tactics like content popping up.
Yeah, that's the big excitement. We had one question in the Facebook group by a guy who is a local to me.
Okay.
And not specifically for our podcast, just in general, he was wondering what people usually do for field guns. Like, do they have them all based together? Because he's playing 15mm. Or should he have each individual guy based and the field gun based by itself, or should we do like
that's a good these ones? Is this in a context of a specific game or just in general?
No, tactics.
Oh, okay. For tactics, you want to be able to remove guys as crew as casualties. Mm-hmm. So the this is one of those things, because the problem is if you base gun crews individually, it always like looks kind of jank.
Yeah,
because you have to like just like cluster them around the gun, and it never looks good. If you want to, especially if it's a gun that has like, you know, a guy who's loading and a guy, you know, like it'll just look like shit. So On one hand, the most like correct way for the rules with the least fucking around is to base them individually so you can take off casualties. Plus that way, because a gun crew can leave the gun and wander around.
Yeah, exactly.
Now, if you don't want to do that because it doesn't look good, just base them like all on and just mark, like put a little token or something, or a little plastic thing, like a poker chip or something. Or not poker chip, but like a little, you know, just a little marker to indicate how many guys you've lost. Yeah, it's just some people will be really bothered by not looking like optimal and some won't care about it. So yeah, if you're building
just magnetize everything. It's all magnetized.
Yeah, you can. I think having them based individually will, if you use that gun with a different game, then it's the most flexible because you can always remove guys if you need or adjust the crew size or whatever. So yeah. But if the visuals bother you, just base them the way that the manufacturer intended and then just mark off who died. And then just have some extra guys like sitting, lying around if you need to send them off on their own without their gun or something.
Yeah. I think that's what we decided on in the end. But it's always that's one of those things. Like, what is the right choice when it comes to those kind of crude guns that you don't necessarily have to stick around with?
Yeah, it comes up like with like Flames of War and stuff like that. Too, where again, like you got like one dude who's like loading, so he looks dumb on his own, like carrying a grenade around.
Just wandering around with a shell.
Yeah. Like so yeah. Just do whatever works for you. So, and I would recommend basing individually. Psychic is saying base the gun with empty spaces for the crew.
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, if you don't mind how it looks, you could make one of those bases that you can like slot them into. There's like little holes for the bases, especially in 15.
Yeah,
just do a slightly larger base with. Yeah, that's probably pretty good because then you kind of get it both ways. You can do the base up with a little prep work so that it looks nice, and then you can move them off. So if you don't mind a little extra work,
and I'm just gonna give a quick shout out to the people who joined in, who we kind of ignored along the way because I didn't really want to interrupt the flow of the description for 5x6 Tactics, but we had Riga show up. Thank you very much.
Hey.
We had Don Juan Don pop in. He's going to catch the rerun. Looking forward to that.
All right.
Rolando Ratis asks if all Canadians are dark elves.
I think Warhammer, Nagaroth is like Canada, basically.
It's true. Like, we do love our torture and slavery and body modification, so.
Yeah. Plus, I've seen what happens after hockey games, so.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we present to the world. You know, the tame stuff. Mini Warmut loves 5 parsecs. Good to see ya.
Hey.
And yeah.
Yeah. I was gonna get one or two other. Oh, Mr. Tom, obviously.
Yeah, Mr. Tom. I think he was the first to arrive too.
Yeah, I think so. Oh no, Noost was here unless he was Well, Tom was the first to post. So
yeah,
Noost was getting his sandwich and he missed out on first post privileges.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, that's harsh. That's what happens if you can't wait on your sandwich. Oh, well, Noost finished painting. So we'll have to look in the Discord.
Nice.
Yeah, we'll have to look in the Discord what that looked like.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of hockey, I was talking to some people. I told them that I had decided to follow the Vancouver Canucks, and they said they were very sorry.
Yes, that is how it goes.
So that should be a good experience.
Yeah, well, I mean... It's not really a good choice if you're trying to follow a Canadian team.
No, it was just one of those, like, since I sort of adopted Vancouver as my sports city, I was like, I'm going to follow a team, it'll be... But they're also getting a women's team, so maybe they won't say.
They might win someday, who knows?
Yeah, it didn't seem likely from what people were informing me. I was like, well, at least you can't complain, being a bandwagon fan, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Rooting for the underdog.
Yeah.
If anyone has any other questions, fire them off. Otherwise, we're going to wrap up.
Leave questions in the comments. You can also just leave comments in the comments.
That's easy. We'll answer comments sometimes.
Sometimes. I need to do a better job at like checking for them. But.
I'm always, usually I'll see the comment when I'm in the middle of doing something else. I'm like, I'll answer that later. And then
yeah. And later it turns out to be like a week later.
Yeah.
All right, guys, have an outstanding evening or night or whatever it is where you are.
And always paint your fish hounds.
Yes,
take care. Bye-bye.
This episode of Bad Internet Friends was streamed live on YouTube and Twitch. There is a North American-friendly live stream every second Wednesday of the month, and a European-friendly live stream every fourth Monday of the month.